I am Bob. I'm an alcoholic. Sober through the grace of God in AA since the 10th of December, 1967, and for that I'm very grateful. I'm really looking forward to this weekend. It has already been kind of special. There's a great feeling about this place, and there's a great feeling about you. I don't know, there's a collective consciousness in every place you go, a group, and it's just a very nice feel. It's also surprising that the majority of people here are women. That is kind of upside down compared to what happens, which is delightful. I'm looking forward to kind of experiencing that. I have my wife with me, so there was no double entendre of... you're kind of a bag lady now. Mary Beth picked us up today. Now you have a bag under your chair. She's a bag lady. And Lena, the taper. I mean, it's not supposed to be Lena and Mike. It's supposed to be Lena and Ole. I mean, that's the Minnesota thing. So I'm going to tell my story in a little bit different way than I normally do, because we're going to spend a lot of hours together, and just given kind of a regular AA talk is not exactly what I think I'm going to do. Is going to be sort of a regular AA talk. I started drinking when I was 13 years old. I was a relatively normal kid, one of seven kids. I lived in St. Paul, Minnesota, which is a kind of a Catholic ghetto. I mean, if you had less than seven children, you had a reproduction problem. There were clans, you know, 6, 7, 8, 10, 12, 15, you know, kids, and families were friends of families. You were friends of the Donovans, you know, and you kind of stair-stepped up, and it was really a great way to grow up. And I was ADD. I mean, then I was just an asshole. I was always in trouble. I was Bugsy. I was a candy addict, which I really think someday we'll find out about, you know. I mean, I ate sugar in amounts that would just boggle your mind. And when I went to high school, I went to a military high school and a Catholic military high school on a college campus. We had fraternities. We drank in high school like most people drink in college. I'm young, I'm insecure. I'm 4'11", 95 pounds in high school. You know, I think mom sent the older ones of us out of the house early, and I was there about a year earlier than many of the kids. And so I had a big mouth. I was always trying to be the clown, kind of, you know, fit in. I got to be a marginal member of the in-group, which is about as good as it got. Then a buddy of mine, we went out and we split a fifth, and my life changed. I mean, it was all the anxiety that I had about fitting in and being as good as and being insecure just disappeared. I mean, it was magic. I remember the first night I got drunk, I was at a party. My sister's 2 years older, and there's at a party with all these upperclassmen. I mean, I just went into the party. I mean, if you would have normally gone into a party, you'd be shining shoes for months, you know, Sam Brown's till your fingers fell off. And now all of a sudden I can, you know, walk around there, and it felt pretty good. I drank a lot for a young guy in high school. Our parents were those Second World War people. They drank hard, played hard, started businesses, were active in the communities, and we stole their booze. And we found out where you could get served. There were lots of places. If you were in a sport coat and a tie, they'd just serve you no matter how old you were. And we had car accidents. I got arrested a couple of times. I was the guy who made the false IDs. And I was a A and B plus student through high school, but my drinking really started to be an issue. My parents were pretty concerned about it, started to get me help. I thought the issue was I was underage. You know, I really didn't get it. I mean, I thought I drank like my friends. My psychiatrist said, I don't think so. I think you just pick different friends and do it more often, which was kind of an insightful thing. I did my first geographic when I went away to college. I went away to the University of Notre Dame. My life was going to change. And it did. It went downhill. I started out as an A student. I ended up at a 2.000. I drank my way out of the University of Notre Dame in the middle of my senior year. I was a class drunk. I look back on this, you know, Rudy, the movie, he went to Notre Dame. I passed through. I mean, it was not, I did not, I mean, which is a story of our lives. You know, we we're good enough to get in. We just don't perform. We interview well. They should get prizes for interviewing, but they don't. They actually want you to perform. I don't know what that is. It seems unreasonable. I was in civil engineering, carrying 25 credits a semester, and I was going to school one day a week. I was cribbing and cramming my way through, and they used my room as a study hall. I mean, I was the guy supporting myself. I was in ROTC. I got a check from the Army, and I was a gambler. You know, I played cards and played, you know, pool. That was how I, you know, supported myself drinking. I had a couple episodes of alcohol poisoning. I almost got thrown out a couple of times for drinking. Long story short, in the middle of my senior year, I just had it and walked out. I was due to be commissioned in the Army. I had to get a medical release. The medical release I got was for alcoholism. I was diagnosed an alcoholic when I was 19. I thought that was goofy. I mean, I really did. I mean, that didn't, you know, most 19-year-olds looking at that, especially in, you know, 1959, that didn't seem like a fit. And I remember, God, I went down to school and I went to the library and I got some book on alcoholism, and it related alcoholism to latent homosexuality. And as unwilling as I was to look at my alcoholism, the combination of those two things was just way beyond my open-mindedness. So I left school, came home, entered, you know, parents obviously pretty disappointed. Linda and I, honey, would you stand up for a sec? Say hi, this is my wife, Linda. She's a 43-year member of Al-Anon. We've been married for 43 years, and I have 43 years of sobriety. So I had my last drink on our honeymoon, which I'll share later. So we've spent a lot of time. We have three boys in recovery. My wife is a carrier. I've turned her into New York. Well, none of us were alcoholic when we met her. And so it's so I came home, I finished school at a local university. Now, in this time, I've cracked up three or four cars. I've, you know, almost died a couple of times. I've been shot at. I've been thrown out of the second story of a building. I've been hospitalized. I've had, you know, these little episodes once or twice a year. My parents are really kind of at the end of their rope. They really don't know what to do. When I finished school, my dad asked me to leave home. He said, "We love you. We just don't know what to do with you." You know, so I went out, got a job at a liquor store, and have to use your gifts. And I did that for about 6 months, got in trouble, got a job as a waiter. I'm living not exactly on Skid Row, but pretty close. And I'm shacked up with, you know, Dr. Seuss, that child author. Those are actual photographs of people I live with during the last year of my drinking. I am about as confused about my life as everybody else who's watching me is. I don't have a clue. It absolutely was not my intent to drink my way out of school. It was absolutely not my intent to be the family jerk. Was, you know, my father was a pretty successful man. My sister did graduate work at the Sorbonne. My brother was Phi Beta Kappa in law school. I mean, you know, I'm lodged between these two show-offs. I mean, I really, you know, I had very traditional ideas about what I should do and what I should accomplish, and I started out thinking I was going to accomplish them, and I was just this enormously immature, somewhat sophisticated kid. I mean, I just didn't have a clue. I just kept on going through. I cared more about what you thought of me than what what I was doing with my life. I mean, it was just nuts. As a waiter, I went out one night, got in trouble, got my face kicked in, and I got fired. And I went home. The family hadn't seen me in quite some time, and I asked if I could move back in the house. I had no place to go. This is during Vietnam. I'm trying to figure out what the service is going to do with me. I got into officer candidate school. I think I'm going to go back to, or I guess that was later. My dad said I could move back in the house. They asked me not to drink. I wasn't able not to drink. I actually started to go through withdrawal. I've been drinking kind of a fifth a day for a better part of a year, and quitting was, I thought, was what they wanted, but I started to fall apart. So I kind of tapered myself off. And when I moved back in the house, I really tried to change my life. And I got back together with Linda. We'd gone together for We're never quite sure. We've been together so long. We'd gone together for about a year, broke up for about a year, and then I got together with her. Got a job. The service ended up, they lost my physical, asked me to take it again, and they failed me. Fourth time I took the physical, so I didn't have to go to Vietnam. That was a good deal. And I got a job, and I thought, wow, bought a car. Thought, you know, I'm going to be a grown-up. Wrong. I am now the company drunk. I mean, I am, you know, I mean, they like to have you come in on Mondays and stay on Fridays, and they have lunch hours. I mean, I was so ill-equipped for, you know, I'm in this company of engineers, and I am literally the clown. I used up my sick leave in the first 2 or 3 months of work. I mean, I am a basket case. Sleeping my hangovers. I've got a photographer. I used to sleep my hangovers off in the dark room. You know, used to hide me when people were looking for me. Quit that job. I remember when I went back to make amends to that guy, he said, you interviewed so well. We could never fix... I said, we do that. We do interview well. Yes, we do. We just can't perform. It's just it's a small flaw. It's a defect of character. And so I quit that job about the time I probably would have lost it. And I got a sales job, which I thought would give me more flexibility. Such a loser. I mean, I'm not making any sales calls. I'm hiding out. I'm drinking every day. I'm drinking, going down to the bar at 8 o'clock in the morning, and I'm phoning up my activity reports. And I'm just, it's just horrible. I mean, I have no idea what I'm doing. And I don't know, someday in July, I guess, 1967, I woke up. That was my moment of truth. I mean, it had a lot of information. I thought what they were telling me, I had a drinking problem. I woke up that morning, I'm hugging the toilet, and dry heaves, I'm just sick, it's 10 o'clock in the morning, I missed work. A buddy of ours was getting married, and we had been drinking all week. And I'd had the bridal dinner, I guess, the night before. Had these vague, had a blackout most of the night, and I was really sick. And all of a sudden, the recommendation of my father and my psychiatrist that I call AA. It's interesting. Everybody was pushing me towards AA, which is unusual for a psychiatrist, 19, 20-year-old kid, 21-year-old kid. So I called Intergroup, asked the operator for the number of AA, and she gave it to me. And I got on the phone with an old-timer who's now dead, and he talked to me for about 10 minutes and then called someone else on another line and lined up two guys to talk to me. And so I agreed that I'd go meet these two guys at 6 o'clock for dinner Thursday night. And after I called, I was kind of, I thought I kind of overreacted. I found out I still had a job and still had a fiance. We were getting the rings back in those days if we acted up too much, and I was a little worried that I had crossed over the Rubicon. And but I wanted to go see what an alcoholic looked like. I mean, you talk about God using delusion and I went and met these two men. One guy had 6 months, one guy had 6 years. And they sat me down in a booth, and they said, we're from AA. We had a drinking problem. We found an answer in Alcoholics Anonymous. We want to share it with you. And they told me their drinking story. And they said, if it helps you, that's good. If it doesn't help you, and you don't want it, don't worry about it. For some reason, it helps us talking to guys like you. So, you know, just relax. I mean, it was wonderful. I mean, it was the power. Those two men in sharing their life with me changed my life that day just by telling me the drinking history. I found myself identifying and talking about things with them that I was reluctant or unable to talk about with my psychiatrist or other helpers. And I had lots of other helpers, doctors, lawyers, Indian chiefs, priests, bishops, everybody, doctors. And I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I met Warren at my first meeting. My sponsor is 91 years old. He is 57 years sober. Two Christmases ago, his 96-year-old sister, who's 59 years sober, he was visiting her, and he fell down the basement stairs and broke his arm and recovered from that. He's been fine now. He has gone downhill, and he's in an Alzheimer's unit in a nursing home. It is so hard to go see that man. It is not you know, he hasn't been the same man for some time, but he really is not the same man right now. And he was a 12-step champion of the Uptown group of Alcoholics Anonymous. He did more 12-step work. He was a mailman. He did more 12-step work than anybody in that place. And I got to be his wingman. And we did it all. It was very cool. And he was perfect. His wife was Linda's sponsor. And they were just a great couple for us. When I went to my first meeting, I thought you were going to give me a test. I've been tested a lot. And asked me why I was there, and no one did. You know, the most amazing thing about Alcoholics Anonymous, I think one of the things I like, is no one ever asks you why. Why did you park the car in the living room? They don't ask you why. I mean, they're because we all have done the unexplainable, and we, even to ourselves, unexplainable, and we didn't know. Warren sat me down in a chair. The other man who was at my first meeting was Bill B., and he assigned me as his temporary sponsor. I got Warren about a month later, and Bill died 3 weeks ago. He was in the same nursing home as my sponsor. What are the odds that the two men who were at your first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, who were your temporary and permanent sponsor, were in the same nursing home, you know, that they did that? But he sat me down in a chair and he said, Bob, alcoholism is a disease. I did not know that. That was a new piece of information. I don't know what the heck. I thought maybe it was a condition. I did not know it was a disease. He said it's threefold, physical, mental, and spiritual. Once you cross the line from problem drinking into alcoholism, your alcoholism affects you all the time when you're drinking and when you're not drinking. That was a new idea. With all the help I got, I never occurred to me that your alcoholism affected you when you were not drinking. Brand new idea. They had explained to me they didn't drink one day at a time. I thought that was a trick, you know, because, I mean, my sponsor had 13 and a half years of sobriety and these other guys had, you know, 6 months, 6 years. But they said, look, it's not a trick. It is a real deal. Can you quit drinking for one day? I said, yeah. I said, that's all you got to do. That was a pretty big deal. He said, what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous, once we take our last drink or drug, we use the 12 steps to change, to find a different way to live that's sufficiently better than the way we lived before, so we don't have to go back to drugs or booze to do something for us that we weren't willing or unable to do for ourselves. If you don't change, you won't stay. That was like the Gettysburg Address of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, have you ever quit? I said, yep. He said, did it work? I said, no. He said, it didn't work for me either. He said, there's a difference between abstinence and sobriety. And it has to do with what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. It has to do with the steps, has to do with meetings, has to do with 12-step work. And we'll explain that. He said, kid, you're young. You'll diagnose yourself over the first 6 weeks that you're here. Go to a lot of meetings, and you will, at the end of that period of time, you'll come to your conclusion whether you're one of us or not. And that's exactly what happened to me. And I've had the privilege of being very active in AA and doing a lot of different things. My sponsor and I never talked at our AA group for the first 25 years. All the meetings we had were closed-step discussion meetings. We only had one speaker meeting a month, and by tradition, we had outside speakers. So I talked at jails and treatment centers and prisons and those sorts of things, and that's how I learned how to give an AA talk. Because I got sober so young, I had my last drink on our honeymoon. I was sober 3 months when we were married, and I had a slip that I think was planned. It wasn't, I'm kind of a phony, so it wasn't, I mean, it wasn't like a real plan, but I don't think there was any question about it that I was going to drink on our honeymoon. Drove off those cliffs in Mexico where the divers dive off those cliffs on my last drunk. Almost could have very easily killed myself. It was almost jumped. If I would have jumped, I would have died. And said to my wife, when we used to go down there for years afterwards, and we were one night watching the divers, and she gave me, on our 10th anniversary, gave me a picture of the chasm at La Quebrada, and I said, that's the dumbest thing I've ever done. And she said, it's not even in the top 10. So I was a couple of weeks after my 24th birthday that I got sober. I'm now 67, so I've lived most of my life in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it has been a fascinating journey and a very different journey than I would have expected. I expected that we'd talk a lot about how not to drink. We have almost had no conversations in my entire experience in Alcoholics Anonymous about how not to drink. The book kind of assumes we quit, and it talks about, helps us live in such a way that we don't go back and start again. But it doesn't really talk about how not to, which I love. It talks about how to live life, and I've had a lot of difficulty in learning how to live life. I have always I've always felt like I'm a guy who's has a team of six horses that I'm holding on to and barely in control through most of my life. I'm a head first, 60 miles an hour, no helmet, spring-loaded guy, ADD, and I have had the consequences of that way of going through my own life. And so I have made lots of mistakes on the way to kind of finding out my path. And that's what I think I intend to share with you this weekend is the wisdom or lack of wisdom of that path. I had really significant, you know, people ask me today, what's the difference between who comes in AA today and who came in when you came in the 60s? And I said, I don't know, it's a hard question to answer, but if I had to answer it, I said in the 60s they were 40, 45-year-old, almost all men, almost all married, almost all churched, almost all had their careers, whether they were construction workers or lawyers. I mean, they kind of knew what they were. They were painters or whatever the heck they were. They were probably going to end up staying that. And once you got them sober, they talked about being returned to normalcy. About half the group were my type A alcoholics from the group, but a very large portion of the people drank for 20, 25 years and slopped over a line. And once they became a pickle, there was no going back to being a cucumber. They just, you know, they didn't do it. But when they started to get sober, they had a lot of kind of pillars to hang on to. I said, the difference today is the person we're getting today is from 20 to 35, started drinking or using when they were in their teens, and they were screwed up. Many of them are not educated. Most of them are not married, or they blew through a marriage. And they don't have the pillars of support in their life. It's more like habilitation rather than rehabilitation. You know, so you're really, it's a different animal, I think, the cross-section, but they're still the alcoholics of today. It is, I don't feel like we're being inundated by mistakes. They're just who we are today. We are reflective of our society, and that's what's happening in our society today, but it's different. I mean, the men and women who greeted me when I came in Alcoholics Anonymous, it was just phenomenal. I mean, they treated me as well as any place I have ever been. They just nurtured us and took care of us. It was really phenomenal. Because I was young and because I was really pathologically immature and because I was married and because we started to have children, I started to have my unmanageability showed up in my parenting, in my work. I mean, I had trouble getting to work. I had trouble staying at work, and I had trouble working at work. Other than that, I was a good worker. And I'm not talking for 3 months. I'm talking for 6 or 7 years. I made changes later in my sobriety. I didn't man up until I was about 31 years old. Today, I don't think that's so unusual. I can't tell you how much shame I had about not manning up earlier, about being the angry father who was physical sometimes with his kids, about not knowing how to work, about being a money spender and not, you know, the unmanageability of my life was a significant problem all the way through my early sobriety until my kind of second experience in AA, which I don't think is an unusual experience. I think that many of us make enormous changes very early in sobriety, plateau out, start to run into the unmanageability in sobriety. That's really a major disappointment and a confusion, because we talk about the program working. Well, if it works, why the hell am I still in so much trouble? Why is my life still so unmanageable, which I think is one of the conundrums for many of us who are active in sobriety. And that's the real conversation. How do you practice these principles in all your affairs? And I couldn't tell you. Last month, my sponsor and I had 100 years of sobriety together. Last month, our three boys and I had 100 years of sobriety. It happened within a week of each other, which was really kind of extraordinary. And that's not counting Linda's recovery. I don't know if they count Al-Anon years and whole years, or do they? Probably going to pay for that later, but what's up? But the fact is, today I have a good relationship with our three boys, and I'm in love with my wife, and I've had some real serious business difficulties last year, and I went broke in 1991. So I'm going to refer to a couple of, you know, major upsets that have been going on in my life, and how well and not well I've been dealing with those, trying to use the program. Life has a lot of texture. If you're going to be around here a long time, you're going to, the relationship you have with your God, the relationship you have with Alcoholics Anonymous, the relationship you have with your spouse, the relationship you have with your sponsor, the relationship you have with your group, maintaining that relationship is really important. And that is one of the things that, and you're going to run into periods of time that are just tougher in hell. I don't care who you are. You're going to have your turn in the barrel. It's just in the last couple of years, it seems like everybody's getting a turn. I'm very pleased to be here. Linda said to me when she came in, and she's kind of intuitive, I think this is going to be a special weekend. And Sandy Beach is a man that I love. He's, I think, the Chamberlain of today in Alcoholics Anonymous. He's a very special guy, and the time I have with him doing this is about as much fun for me and about as enjoyable as any time I have, and I will get down. Thank you very much, and I'm looking forward to spending the rest of the time with you.
Well, good evening, everybody. My name's Sandy Beach, and I'm an alcoholic. And like Bob, I'm delighted to be here. We do events together once in a while, and we have more fun. And normally, I go to a lot of conventions, but the retreat-type weekends, I just limit myself. I do one in Tampa, and I find them tiring, and so it's very hard to get me to do this. But if you dangle Bob Bazans in front of my eyes, then somehow I seem to change my mind, and we have a lot of fun together, and it really means a lot. He and Linda have helped me through some times, and it's just great having them on my team. It means a lot to me, and I'm sure each of you has special people in AA that you are so grateful they're in your life, and they're probably grateful that you're in their lives. I got sober in December 7th of 1964 up in Washington, D.C., and I had the same sponsor for 42 years. So Bob and I share something in common, and that is having a long, long time with your sponsor, and it's turns into quite a relationship. And he was a great guy. We were both in the Marine Corps, and we just shared a lot. And I went to, when I found out he was dying, we went back to the first meeting that he took me to up in Virginia. And they arranged for, he was too weak to speak, so I got up and told my story, and then we got together afterwards. And we reminisced about that Manassas group. It's funny, I was just recollecting the other day that one of the guys at my first meeting was Charlie Lindenwood, the Arkansas traveler. Lee knows who he was. He was a real character in AA. And so we reminisced about that, and then I knew I probably wouldn't see him until his funeral because I didn't live near him. And so we said goodbye, and we just agreed that we had one heck of a run together and that it was just wonderful. And so it was a very positive experience. It's funny about AA. You get to see death in an entirely different way. It no longer is a terrifying thing. It's as if you understand the importance of it in the whole spiritual plan. And both of us were able to see it that way, that it is, there's no way you can go through the next door until you close this one. And that's just the way it is. And so it's nice to have a different, and if you are new, that's something to really try and work on. The ego, and I'm getting over off of my story, but I hate my story, so this is all right. One of the great weapons the ego likes to use is death. It's like, woo, and it can really scare you, and it really likes to work on you over that word. And so the more comfortable you can get with that, the more close you can get with your higher power and being at peace with yourself, and just turn it into a bookend part of life. It's just like breathing in and breathing out. It's as a natural event as there is. Let's see. Like I say, I get tired of telling my story, so I was thinking of telling a different version of my story. And in this version, I come to AA, but I don't stay. I don't like it. So I leave and I start an alternate program called Reasonable Recovery, where everything is suggested, even stopping drinking. And in this program, it's just a lot easier. It's just you don't have mean sponsors. You cut a lot of slack. There's no such thing as a slip. We call it going on furlough. And you don't attend the meetings, you just mail in the empties. So we get lots of new members because it's much easier than AA, but no one stays. It's they're there a week or so and on their way. So anyway, I grew up in New Haven, Connecticut. I was born in 1931, so in a little while I'll be 80. And when you're 80, you can just be cranky and do things any way you want and complain at meetings and all that kind of stuff. So I can hardly wait to get there. Become an obnoxious old timer. Oh. I hate old people, I'll tell you. I wouldn't appear on an old timers panel if you paid me. They all complain. So I hang around young people and try to pretend that I'm not old, and it works. It works except for the bones in my body and everything falling apart, but as far as I'm concerned, I'm still 55 or something, so it's a fun way to live. I really do enjoy being around younger people. They're just I just love to watch them grow. The guys I sponsor, what a privilege to sponsor somebody and just watch that miracle take place. So I feel very fortunate. I'm one of the guys that just came in here and just, it became, you know, this is the deal. And my sponsor was that way. And, you know, I don't remember as many slips back in the early 60s. Once in a while, we'd hear about one. But it just, I don't remember anybody in my home group ever having one. It just seemed like people got a sponsor and just started doing the steps. And see, the treatment centers hadn't arrived yet. There weren't any treatment centers to help us understand the complexity of this situation. And if you have 4 months of relapse prevention before you get here, slip is on your mind, you know what I mean? It's almost like it's part of recovery. I'm just teasing. I'm sorry, anybody in the treatment business. I'm old. I can get away with this. And I agree with Bob. There were most of the people were, I don't know. They understood values. They had a foundation, and they lost it. They didn't have to be taught what this moral foundation was. They didn't have to be taught a lot of things. And so it was, the people that I had around me were, God, it was really solid. And I'm very grateful for that. AA was newer. Let's see, in 64, what is it, 33 years old? 35? No, it's 29 years old. God, I came here when AA was 29 years old. And so there was still, I was talking to Clancy about this. He said we were real lucky to get in here during that era. Because AA, and I still have a directory of meetings in Washington, D.C. from 65. And in Northern Virginia, the Maryland area, and all of D.C., there were 9 meetings a day. And so AA was really just getting going, if you follow what I mean. Nobody took it for granted. Nobody, you know, said, wow, God, they don't need my help. There's hundreds of meetings and thousands of people. There was so few that you really were excited when a new meeting got started. Everybody knew about it. And I think now you could start 50 meetings and you wouldn't notice it because the book of meetings is so thick. So it was kind of different in that it was still, is it going to succeed? And there's something exciting about that. If you've ever been involved in a project or a business or anything, is that when the startup part is really exciting. And then after it's been around a while, it's just another job or whatever. So I found AA, the newness of it, really cool. I deeply regret that I was not a history person. Never enjoyed reading about history. Now I go crazy over AA history. Every little memorabilia and all that. And I remember telling somebody, well, did you ever study history? And I said, why should I? It already happened. What do you want to learn that for? So I had such a little interest that I never met Bill Wilson. And my friends would go up to New York for the Wilson dinner, and they go, you want to go? And I said, what am I going to meet Bill Wilson for? Can you imagine? I don't have the money. It costs us $70 to go up there on a train and go to the Bill Wilson dinner and all that. And, of course, now, what do you think I'd give for a photo of me and Bill? Because, boy, he sure became one of my heroes. Oh, my God, him and Chuck Chamberlain. I really grew to love his mind, his writings, and all the blessings that he gave us. Let's see. Trying to remember some things from when I was little. I talk often that the main thing in all our lives then was World War II. But before World War II, I do remember going to the 39 World's Fair in New York City. And my mother took my sister and I down there. And the reason I remember it is they had just invented television. And they had a display of a camera over here and a screen over here and somebody sitting. And you'd see them take a picture and then this lady's face would be over on the screen. And it just blew our minds. It was like it was trickery. There already was a picture in there. They couldn't possibly be taking a picture over here and have it appear over here. It was sensational. And the other things they had was the modern kitchen. Refrigerators, dishwashers, dryers, you know, washing machines, all those things. And, of course, my mother was just going crazy looking at all this stuff that suddenly, and they actually had a modern kitchen, what it would look like. with counters and cupboards and all these appliances that were in there. They were just coming into view. And then along came 1941. A lot of that stuff got put on hold until America went through straightening out this huge problem. And of course, everybody in my family, everybody's family that was of age was in the war or was involved in the defense effort. And being on the East Coast, they had the German submarines there and the blackout, and you had blackout lights on your cars. Drapes had to be pulled at night. The air raid wardens would go around. If they saw light shining through, they'd knock on your door. There's light shining through your door. And so it was very consuming. And the reason I mention it is because of this tremendous threat, people stopped fighting amongst themselves. In the whole country, all the things that separate people, you know, different beliefs and different whatever, they were all put aside because this was such a threat. We're going to have to cool it and stay united. And so it was a different country than it is now. And it's kind of like AA. You don't think we came together out of brotherly and sisterly love, do you? I still think the thing that holds AA together is booze. It's sitting out there reminding us, you guys don't get along, I'll win. I'll be out here. Go ahead. Start fighting with each other. Start fractioning. Start splitting up and see who wins. It'll be me. And so we have that wonderful tradition of unity. And I find, even today, you don't have to hardly teach new people that. They automatically start behaving better in here, not cutting up like they normally did. There's something inside of them that says, I don't think I better mess this place up because my life's on the line. So I'm going to have to hang in here. Now, they may not cooperate with the steps or this and that, but there's sort of the inherent realization that we all better stick together. Then comes the wonderful reward of all sticking together and of understanding each other as a child of God and of forgetting our differences and seeing the tremendous similarities. But it came because of this common enemy. So alcohol actually did a blessing for us. I think it did. I was brought up in the church. My sister and I both sat in the Catholic church in the same pew. She fell in love with the place. She saw nothing but good. She loved the Latin, the incense, the nuns with their little goofy outfits, and the incense and going to confession. Oh, I feel so relieved. I, on the other hand, sitting right next to her, I didn't see anything like that. I saw a very threatening place. I felt very uneasy. Confession, I knew what was going on. They were gathering evidence for later when the sentencing took place. So don't tell them a thing. That was my, you can see how I just saw everything wrong. So the whole issue of God and church became a frightening thing, whereas for my sister, it was a loving thing. So it had nothing to do with the church itself. It was rather my perception of it. And as you learn more about spirituality, you learn that perception is everything. It is the reality. And so my reality was quite different than my sister's, and yet we both became alcoholics. So who's to say? Why she became one and I did. We had such a different backgrounds. It doesn't make any difference. If you're going to become one, you're going to become one. And I look at these efforts to have a thing called alcohol prevention, alcoholism prevention, and I laugh. I just laugh. Oh, really? Because we know in AA, we hear one member after another talk about having two alcoholic parents who treated them so horribly they saw the ravages of alcohol. They said, I will never drink and be like my father. So what better training could you give for alcohol prevention than that? And it doesn't work. If somebody's going to become an alcoholic, they're going to become an alcoholic. And I think we're blessed. And the reason I say that is to really have a spiritual awakening, the ego has to be cracked into. And people don't voluntarily do that. They just don't give up control of their lives voluntarily. There may be a few, but generally, as William James said in his book, Varieties of Religious Experience, these spiritual transformations only occur to people in great desperation. And so you look at AA and you see that we just corner the market on spiritual transformations. We just, I bet in the country, of all the spiritual transformations that take place, most of them take place in AA. And you go, gee, wonder why AA gets so many more spiritual transformations than churches. We corner the market on desperate people. That's why. If a church congregation was 100% desperate people who were on the very edge of their lives, I'm sure they would find more surrenders and transformations like we have. And so I feel very fortunate that I had the disease that forced me to reconsider all of my ideas about life. I mean, it's very hard to get a human being to go, you know, you could be wrong about everything. Why don't we check it out? You're not going to get many takers. Well, I might be wrong about one little thing. You know what I mean, but everything? And so we're forced to do that. Look what happens. We really do get a new beginning. Anyway, my life, I went to college like Bob, and I started drinking in college. Up till then, I was an A student, a good athlete and all that, and one night of drinking, and that was it. Barely graduated, and I think that alcoholics have such a transforming experience through their own drinking. Solves all of the core problems that ever existed inside of us in one evening. It just gives us a new vision on life that is beyond anything we've ever had before. So for an alcoholic, drinking is beyond wonderful. For a non-alcoholic, it's pretty good. So somebody who's having a pretty good experience won't seek it as hard as someone who's having a wonderful experience. In order to keep having a wonderful experience, I'm willing to go to jail, throw up blood, get in fights, lose everything because this experience is so unbelievable. If it was just pretty good, I don't know if I would pay that kind of price. The point I'm making is the reason we're alcoholics is because of what alcohol does for us, not what it does to us. And if it did that for non-alcoholics, they would be alcoholics. So it's very difficult for them to understand why we are willing to pay such a high price for something they treat quite casually. And I found that out when I became a fighter pilot in the Marine Corps and I was overseas. Everybody drank the same. We were all getting drunk all the time. We're flying. We're just, oh, what a great organization. And yet, 9 months into that tour, I'm standing on the end of the runway with this major, big Irish guy who I got drunk with all the time. And he's telling me about getting his own fighter squadron. He wants to get the best Marine Corps pilots in the world. And he wanted me, pointed right at me, a young lieutenant, said, I want you in that outfit. And then he said, but I wouldn't let you drink. And I'm going, I pretend that I didn't hear him. I'm not going to ask him what he means by that. Why would he say that? And it wasn't until I got to AA that I realized I'm in a group of heavy drinkers, and my drinking scared them. I was doing something beyond what they were doing. They were overseas, away from home and everything, so they were drinking, you know, just drinking a lot. I was doing something different. The intensity of my drinking and my relationship to alcohol, he could see, was way more serious than his. And it scared him. And I didn't understand that. I thought I was just another one of the guys over there partying, having fun, doing a good job and all that. So early on, someone spotted my alcoholism. But I didn't, and we ended up with six children. I was making a career out of the Marine Corps. We got transferred all over the place. I had a lot of fun. It was just amazing. But alcohol was slowly squeezing everything else out of my life except my relationship with booze. And then it began its job of slowly taking everything away. And near the end, I was flying with alcoholic withdrawals. I didn't know what to do about it. There was no alcohol program. There was no diagnosis in the Navy of alcoholism. Nobody could have it because it didn't exist. You could have mental disorders, you could go see a psychiatrist, but there was no alcoholism. And therefore there were no alcohol programs. And I never heard of AA. And so I just knew that I was going to handle this on my own. Whatever it was, as horrible as it was up to me to keep doing it. So I kept getting back in the plane, and it was very terrifying because withdrawals cause quite a lot of anxiety. Your heart starts racing. The vision is difficult to see. And, man, I'm up in these jets by myself. And I feel like I'm going to pass out. Can I finish the mission? And I'm shaky. And so I hit around, but I was serious. There were a period of about 4 or 5 months where when these attacks would come, I would put one hand on the ejection seat, and I was in a photo plane, and all the cameras were on the stick. So you could fly the whole mission with one hand. So my theory was, if I got this and I'm flying the mission and I pass out, bam! The ejection seat will fire. I go out, the plane crashes, the chute opens automatically at 10,000 feet. Problem solved. Did anybody relate to that thinking? Well, I used to have a problem, but now I don't. So you're looking for insanity. There it is. And eventually, it came to an end on a cross-country in a different airplane we had in the squadron. This was during the Cuban Missile Crisis. We had a radar plane that we could use to jam radars so the photo planes could get in undetected. And we were coming back from a cross-country. I tell this story everywhere because of what happened in Brentwood a couple years ago. And all of a sudden, I had to get out of the plane. Something was happening so severe, it probably was the onset of a seizure or something like a seizure. And I just said, I have to get out of this thing. And it didn't have an ejection seat. It was an old F3D straight wing plane, and it had a panel that you pulled up, and then a chute went down, and you slid down it, kind of like escaping from commercial airline. You know, they open the chute and then everybody slides out. And I was trying to remember how that worked. I hadn't paid attention too much demonstration. So I was looking at it, and then I went, oh, my God, this guy doesn't know how to fly. He's a radar guy, so I can't just leave him here. He has no idea I'm thinking this. So I called the flight leader and told him we had an oxygen emergency. And when you do that, you have to land right away because it really is an emergency. So he spotted an Air Force base nearby. It was VFR, and we just went right down, landed, and I feel like I'm going to sneeze. Went into the O Club, had a couple drinks. I felt better. Didn't have an emergency anymore. But the next morning when we went out and the maintenance people said there's no problem with the oxygen, and I took a look at the plane, I told the flight leader, I'm not going to do this anymore. He said, what aren't you going to do? I said, I'm not going to fly anymore. And he looked at me going, well, you've been doing it your whole life. This is your whole thing, 14 years. I said, I'm not going to do it anymore. He said, why? I would not say anything except I'm not going to do it anymore. So I don't really remember. Somebody else flew back, and I had to go see the colonel. And he said, what's this I hear? You're not going to fly? I said, yes, sir, I'm not going to fly anymore. Why? I'm not going to fly anymore. I would not say why. My alcoholism just informed me that I was going to give up flying. And he had no choice but to take me at my word and write a letter to the headquarters of the Marine Corps. I had to voluntarily resign from being a fighter pilot, and they would reassign me something else in about 3 months. And once I did that, I felt so much shame, I couldn't look at the other pilots. There were only 15 pilots. They were all captains, a couple majors, and one lieutenant colonel, very exclusive photo squadron. And so they gave me the job of doing the legal work. I did the special court martials and Article 15s. And I never looked at, I never made eye contact with my friends anymore. They would come by and I'd just be working. And I never felt so ashamed in my life. And I knew what they were thinking. They were looking in there going, look at that piece of crap. How'd he get in this outfit? You know, what a horrible thing that we had to put up with that guy. And when I got out of there, I was really happy to get away from all that pressure. I was retrained as an air traffic controller. And that's what I did in my last year of drinking. I was in charge of a unit overseas. But fortunately, the senior enlisted men saw what shape I was in, and they just said, Captain, just try to get to work. We'll handle everything. But you are not going to talk to any airplanes. And so that was, and eventually I had a seizure and ended up in a military nut ward for 6 months. And that's where I found AA. And a couple of years ago, I was invited out to California, Los Angeles. I went to different meetings. And the Brentwood group is a real cool group. It's 500 people. A lot of California meetings are big. And the format is they get an old-timer to talk about a topic, and then people raise their hand and ask them questions. And Chuck Chamberlain used to be a regular there, and you can imagine how popular that would be to ask him, you know, tell me about this, tell me about that. And the lady was getting her 30-year medallion. She was driving to the meeting. Her husband was driving her. He's not an alcoholic, but he loves AA, knows all about it. But that night, he was just going to have coffee, and she said, well, the leader tonight is Sandy Beach. And he said, was he a pilot? And she said, yeah, he was. Well, I think I know him. Tell him to come out here. So I went out in the parking lot, or just outside the door, and there he was. I never saw him before. And he looked at me and said, in 1962, you were flying in a flight of four F-3Ds on a cross country coming back to Cherry Point. You declared an oxygen emergency, and you never flew again. And I said, my God, how you know that? He said, I was in the plane with you. So what are the odds of running into that guy after 42 years, and he wasn't a radar guy, he was another pilot. He had been recalled from American Airlines for the Cuban Missile Crisis, and there was a hurricane coming to Cherry Point, and when that happens, you fly all the planes somewhere safe, and you drink until the hurricane goes away, and then you go back, so there wasn't any radar guys going on that mission. It was all the hero pilots, and that's why he was coming along. And I had to believe him, right? I mean, who the hell else would know that? And I said, I'll be damned. His name was Jim Heth, and we've become pretty good buddies. And we talk on the phone, and I saw him about 3 months ago. 2 months ago, I was out in L.A. And the next night, I was at another convention, and he came and brought photographs of the squadron. He had his photo book. He had all these things. And I'm going, oh, yeah, oh, I didn't remember that guy. I didn't remember that. Then he said this. He said, did you know how popular you were in that squadron? It was killing us that you were leaving. The colonel did everything to try and fix this. We were running around. We didn't know how to get you help. We talked to headquarters. We talked to everybody. There was no, even the doctor didn't know, the flight surgeon. And he said, when you left, we were really sad. And I said to myself, well, that's not how I remember it. One of us is wrong. And I decided his version of the truth was probably more accurate than mine. So I had to go back to 1962 and change my own past. And I replaced my own ideas with the truth. That is called spirituality. That is what spirituality is. It is discovering the faulty nature of your own ideas and replacing them with the truth. That's why it's so much fun to go down the spiritual path. And when they say old ideas avail us nothing, that's what they're talking about. They're talking about your ideas and how wrong they are. Isn't it fun to get rid of your crappy past and replace it with the truth? There was a speaker who said, jokingly, his story was divided into two parts, what happened during the years that he drank, and what he thought happened during the years that he drank. And that's could be said about all of our lives. Your childhood is divided into two parts, what happened when you were a child and what you thought happened. And then when we get sober and we start working the steps and we have a good sponsor who guides us, our family straightens out. It wasn't what we thought. I was just, a couple weeks ago, some guy was telling me, a friend of mine in Tampa, he said, I went back to my high school reunion. He said, I couldn't believe it. Every picture of me, I'm smiling. I remember it as being terrible. And my friends told me, no, you were having a good day. Really? Really? So this is the blessing of having an open mind and being willing to reconsider your own life and your ideas about it. And wow, how many people get to do that? You know how blessed we are to find a place where they guide us towards the truth in such a wonderful atmosphere. And our teachers are other drunks with no training in teaching about spirituality other than their own experience. And we're forced to listen to them because they're just like us. And I just can't thank you all enough for what you gave me. Thanks.
All right, Bob.